Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. In the next hour, we take a look at the year ahead in Africa and ask whether the political unrest of the Arab world will spread.
Yes, there are tremendous problems, but yes, there's also been a lot of progress in the last couple of decades.
We'll be listening out not just for good tunes, but also good business sense from the people that put together Music Week with their 2012 forecast. And then we'll head to New York to visit digital guru Hashem Bajwa to hear about the tech stories set to dominate the news agenda in 2012. All that, plus some great music, here on Midori House, live from Studio One in London. We've got a lot of crystal ball gazing to get through, but first, let's get the latest news from around the world with Christian Yeo.
Monocle 24 News. Syrian state television says a suicide bomber has killed up to 25 people in Damascus. At least 46 others were injured in the blast in Midan district. Syria's state news agency blames terrorists for the attack. Last month, opposition leaders accused President Bashar al-Assad's forces of staging suicide attacks to instill fear in the country. Arab League monitors are still inside Syria to see whether the government is complying with its promise to end the violence against protesters. The Arab League chief has asked the Damascus-based leader of the Palestinian group Hamas to work with Syria to find a resolution. Secretary General Nabil El Arabi says more needs to be done if a peace agreement is to be maintained. Airbus insists its flagship A380 passenger jet is safe after two airplanes reported cracks forming in the model's wings. Planes used by Qantas and Singapore Airlines were found to have cracks but were deemed safe and underwent cosmetic repair. Steve Pervenat from the Australian Licensed Aircraft Engineers Association has accused the Civil Aviation Safety Authority of having no teeth.
They should be coming out and making sure these aircraft are grounded today, but they tend to follow the lead of the regulators in Europe and in the States, and those regulators in turn are driven by Airbus and Boeing, who have a commercial interest to make sure these aircraft continue to fly.
Thousands of people have held a demonstration in Yemen against the detention of anti-government protesters. Opposition supporters gathered in the capital Sana'a, calling on acting President Abed Rabu Mansour Hadi to release those being held captive for opposing the state. A group of children wore handcuffs and tape over their mouths as part of the rally to symbolise the prisoners being held. A Dutch man accused of murdering a woman in Peru has appeared in court. Joran van der Sloot is alleged to have strangled Stephanie Flores in a Lima hotel room. The 24-year-old defendant was also the prime suspect in the unsolved 2005 killing of American Natalie Holloway. The Beijing city government is to release the results of stricter air pollution standards. The move follows public outcry that authorities are understating the extent of smog in China's capital. Many Beijing residents say they can only trust pollution readings from the US embassy, which has its own measurements that appear much grimmer than the city government's. Poles celebrated the Christian holiday of Three Kings in Warsaw today, with costume parades and nativity plays, marking 12 days after Christmas. Banned during communist times in Poland, it's the third year the procession's been held in Warsaw since resuming the tradition. Leah Cleff, an American tourist, says she was impressed by the colourful event.
In America, it's just like Catholics only do it. They celebrate this day, but in Poland, everybody gets here, and it's really cool.
And some of the stories which made the papers on Friday. The Jordan Times reports that Egyptian prosecutors have called for Hosni Mubarak to be hanged, saying he bore full responsibility for the killing of protesters during the uprising against him. Canada's Globe and Mail says police in Ottawa are warning of a pattern in prostitute murders. The Norway Post says nearly 50% of Norwegian industrial firms believe they'll have higher income in 2012 than last year. And London's Daily Telegraph says British courts will be given powers to ensure divorced parents are given access to their children. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Christian. Now let's take a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
In Europe, the weather has certainly settled down in Western countries after a week of wind and rain, a vast amount of snow in the Alps too, in Val d'Isère last night, an avalanche and winds gusting to 200 kilometres an hour. The eastern Mediterranean will bear the brunt now of heavy rain clouds and high winds all the way from Italy, the Greek islands, the Balkans, Turkey and even Cyprus. The next 2 days, a disruptive storm here. The weekend's city outlook: London, 9 degrees, partly cloudy. In Zurich, it's 4 degrees with rain. Helsinki, minus 2, partly cloudy. In Istanbul, 8 Celsius and rain. And in North America, fairly quiet weather here at the moment. A little snow in Montreal, yes, plus the freezing temperatures, but that's to be expected. In the US, lots of sunshine along the eastern seaboard, not too cold either. Clear in the Rockies as well, but by far the best weather conditions are in California. Beautiful and sunny all the way from San Francisco to San Diego. The weekend's city outlook: Montreal, minus 5 degrees with snow flurries. New York City, plus 8 and sunny. Las Vegas, 14 Celsius and sunny. And in San Francisco, 15 with sunshine too. Other world destinations for the next few days: in the Middle East, in Abu Dhabi and Dubai, warming up through the weekend as a desert breeze will raise the temperatures from 22 to about 28 Celsius. In Asia and Beijing, mostly sunny skies. By day, it's about 0 degrees here. At nighttime, down to minus 8. And in Tokyo, fine weather too, just a few clouds, 8 Celsius. In fact, most of Japan enjoying fine weather. And on that note, have a good weekend. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Thomas. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 highlights, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, ei ole kosau.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Proper Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This week, we've been talking to academics, professionals and industry insiders about how the next 12 months might look for the world. In the final part of our global briefing series, our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield turned his attention to Africa. Joining him in the studio were Katrina Manson, East Africa correspondent for the Financial Times, Jamie Drummond, executive director of advocacy group One, and Joel Kubazo, an African media consultant. Steve began by asking Joel whether the Arab Spring could spread south of the Sahara.
I actually think that one of the reasons that similar events haven't taken place in sub-Saharan Africa is because of changes that have happened in sub-Saharan Africa over the last 20 years, since about 1991. We're talking about an area, just to take this year, where we've had in 2011, you had elections in Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, the Ivory Coast, Uganda, Zambia, and in a number of those cases, I mean, you did have either, if not changes of government, but changes of personnel. So that heated political sort of situation has been in some ways reduced compared to the countries that have seen those kind of changes in North Africa. I mean, in the last year, I was in each of those three countries in North Africa, and you could actually, the tension was palpable, and on the streets, and just people talking about things and saying that, look, something had to give. And so it wasn't a complete surprise. I mean, I didn't know when anything was going to happen, but it wasn't a complete surprise that something did happen and that there was that sort of uprising against those regimes. I think in sub-Saharan Africa, that is not the case. And even if we look at 2012, we've got elections that are likely to be in Zimbabwe, Kenya, Ghana. So what I'm saying is that I think the tensions aren't as great as perhaps they once were when totalitarian regimes ruled the whole continent.
Jamie, there are two things, though, that a number of countries in sub-Saharan Africa have in common, and that's fairly autocratic governments in some places, but also, crucially, huge youth unemployment.
Yeah, but there's also a process of democratization. It doesn't happen overnight. Compare the progress from 20 years ago, the beginning of the 90s. There are three democracies by any description on the continent, and now there are, in the region of 20 of some description, and there are, in any given year, on average, roughly about a dozen elections of some kind. So, yes, there are tremendous problems, but yes, there's also been a lot of progress in the last couple of decades. You asked why it hasn't spread into south of the Sahara. There's going to be some really interesting elections, as Joel just referred to, in 2012 that might be real test cases. But there'll be one moment that's a kind of a pop cultural moment as well, in our view, that's kind of interesting, which is Equatorial Guinea and Gabon will co-host the African Confederations Cup, where a lot of, Premier League stars will all be down there. those two countries aren't great examples of African democracy.
No, they are far
also
from it.
Exactly. I was using a term of speech. They are also countries that have problems with their natural resources and how they've governed those. They have considerable youth unemployment, like many other parts of the country. And I think it'll be interesting to see how that goes, and how people cover, how journalists and how others cover this moment when a lot of young men will be watching their heroes in places that in some ways you would find hard to look up to the democracy of those countries. And maybe that's a sort of, if you're looking for moments that might be pop cultural flashpoints, maybe that will be one. But I think the notion that an Arab Spring was supposed to lead to an African summer probably doesn't do justice to a lot of the things that have already happened south of the Sahara, a lot of progress that has already taken place, and a mixed bag.
That was Jamie Drummond and Joel Cabazzo in Studio One earlier. You can hear more of that and a whole series of global briefings on our website at www.monocle.com/24. And I'm joined now in the studio by our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for coming in, Steve.
Quite right.
I wonder if maybe you could just start by saying, how did that discussion develop? Mentions of an African summer, or the unlikelihood that an Arab Spring would turn into sub-Saharan African summer. Do you agree with that?
Yes and no. I think it's, the countries in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, are in a very different place from the ones north of the Sahara. You've got, more of them are democracies or sort of democracies. You've got less out-and-out dictatorships. And actually, instead, you've got, they're at a slightly different stage. So they're, if you look at a country like Kenya, which, is a democracy but had, huge problems at their last election in 2007 and will probably experience very similar problems this time around later when they go to the polls in 2012.
And these are problems, like you mentioned there, about youth unemployment particularly, which is...
Yes, and so that's
a big spark for...
Exactly, and that is one thing that obviously they really do have in common with their North African cousins, is that there is huge youth unemployment, particularly amongst men, and also particularly amongst well-educated men. So people who've gone to university, they've racked up some debts, they've graduated, they expected they would have some sort of job at the end of it, and they don't. And they are, and they're young, they're angry, and they're educated. And that is a very potent combination if you are a leader with millions of these types of people in your country.
And tell us a little bit about the power players in these regions.
So I think it's, you've got an interesting situation happening in Senegal at the moment, which is one of the big countries in West Africa, where the president there, Abdoulaye Wade, is running for re-election next month. He's been in power, I think this will be his third term. He's over 80 years old. He wants to hand over to his son at some stage, and he's been going to be opposed this election by Youssou N'Dour, the Senegalese singer. So that'll be an interesting one to watch. There'll be, as I mentioned, the election in Kenya. There's a very interesting election that's going to take place in Ghana, which had very little coverage of its last election because it all went off smoothly. There were no problems whatsoever. The opposition won by something like 40,000 votes, a fraction of, 0.5% of the vote. And yet the ruling party said, OK, fine, we lost, we'll hand over power. So they have another election this year, and I think that will be a really interesting one to see whether it runs as smoothly as last time. I think it will, and I think it will be ignored by most news outlets in the same way.
And I want to ask you a little bit about Somalia, because Ban Ki-moon obviously made quite a high-profile visit there. And news that the UN is moving there, people from Nairobi to Mogadishu. How will people in Nairobi sort of feel about that, do you think? You've lived there yourself.
Those that work for the UN probably won't be that happy. Nairobi has its problems, but it's a far nicer place to live than Mogadishu. I think Somalia is, and we talked about this in the programme as well. We could have done this programme every year for the past 20 years and we'd say, guys, it could be a really bad year for Somalia, isn't it? And it's going to be a really bad year for Somalia. You've got, it's a country that's had been racked by civil wars, by other conflicts for more than two decades. It doesn't have a functioning central government and hasn't had one for 20 years. And at the moment, you've got Kenyan troops inside Somalia, you've got Ethiopian troops inside Somalia, you've got an African Union force, and you've got the Americans and the French doing sort of behind the scenes stuff as well. So I think that will be one to watch for the rest of the year.
One to watch, definitely. Well, you can hear all of the roundtable discussion on www.monocle.com/24. Thank you very much for joining us, Steve.
That's quite all right.
Now time for a song. This is Quantic Soul Orchestra with Alice Russell with their song Pushing On. That was Quantic Soul Orchestra with Alice Russell and, well, the song was called Pushing On. In just a moment on Midori House, we'll be talking music industry. That's after this.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, will make you feel like you've seen, heard, watched, attended and danced to the finest and most exciting events in the world's cultural calendar.
They're like metal, glam, monster band.
They've literally just put some names of pop groups in a bag and shook it.
What is this fantastic place where all these bands still exist?
That's Culture with me, Robert Bound, available all week. Find us at monocle.com or iTunes, download our app and listen on your phone, or just stay tuned to Monocle 24. Thanks for tuning in.
Feliz Ano Novo da Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 より明けましておめでとうございます。
ボードグイエヴェットアモノコ24.
Her du tastet, så vidt Monocle 24.
Bonne année de la part de Monocle 24.
Ein frohes neues Jahr von Monocle 24.
Felice Ano Novo da Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 より明けましておめでとうございます。
Gott nytt år fra Monocle 24.
Happy New Year from Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now it's the start of the year and every industry is looking ahead. Music Week is the industry bible that keeps an ear out at all times on, yes, the music industry. And we're joined now in the studio by senior staff writer Tom Pakinkas. Tom, a very warm welcome to Midori House. I wonder if maybe you could start by talking, we've been speaking quite a bit about file sharing, and I'm wondering if people, is there a move in the industry for people to be music fans or users rather than music owners? Have people sort of stopped buying?
I think this move that we're seeing towards streaming services and as you say, file sharing, obviously of the legal kind that we're talking about here. I think it definitely is getting more popular, you know, the numbers show that. And it's just a case of how quickly that change is coming and at what point it will stop. Last year, UK album sales were accounting for around 76% were CDs still. So, you know, the majority of album sales in the UK, at least, and you can probably extrapolate that.
Of course, well, we've just had figures in that the album sales in the States have been as high as they have been since 2004.
But I mean, we've seen a rise in digital in the UK at least of 26-27%. That's year on year, you know, for 2011.
But and is this in a particular sector? Is it, I mean, presumably it's slightly older people who are still buying CDs, or in
the thing is, it's general, but you're seeing a lot of different models out there. There's no one set streaming model. I mean, you've still got iTunes, which is still very predominant, and you know, you've got BlackBerry brought out BBM Music, which has a different way of looking at the streaming model. So we're still not sure how it's going to settle and what kind of model we're going to finish upon. So whether music fans are going to be owners or you know, just passively sort of drifting through their ownership almost, you know, it's still unclear.
Still unclear, of course. Now, the big thing also that we have is the Olympics in the UK, and it's the sound of the Olympics nobody's really sort of spoken about. Mm-hmm. Is it going to be a British sound, do you feel, or is it an opportunity for sort of world music?
I think it's going to be mainly British, obviously, and it's, you know, this is probably the same for every industry that's involved. It's going to be a showcase for Britain to the rest of the world. I mean, we've got Danny Boyle, obviously the famous film producer, he's been the director of the opening ceremony. We've got two guys from a British electronic group called Underworld, who are going to be the musical directors.
We all remember them from Trainspotting.
Yeah, and And so they're obviously it's a British team behind this, but Danny Boyle spoke about them and said they've got a very broad sort of range of influences, and obviously Britain's a very multicultural place now. It itself has a very broad range of influences. So who knows what they'll drag into their musical showcase at the opening ceremony? But you know, I think it is going to be a British showcase. But Britain's about the world these days.
Of course, and actually the British music industry is doing very well abroad. Mm. And last year, I mean, Adele was on everybody's lips and in everybody's ears, and I think she's just risen to number one in the US charts again, hasn't she?
Yeah.
Is there anything that's going to stop her?
Her album is still doing incredibly well. You know, next year she's just getting over a throat operation, actually. So unfortunately, she has been.
It's lucky for her that her album has managed to last this long, then, isn't it?
But you know, we're all looking forward to equally barnstorming live performances from her, hopefully next year. You know, and obviously another album further down the line.
And I mean, looking at Adele's success, are there any lessons that can be learnt?
I think the thing about Adele is she didn't release on streaming services, not the album 21 anyway, the one that's done so well. There was only the one song, the famous single Rolling in the Deep, that was on the streaming services. And what that means is that you've got this album that, in a time when people are talking about the death of the CD, I mean, it's broken records that stretch right back to the 60s, you know, the Beatles and things like that. So you can always buck the trend if that raw talent and the content on the CD is good enough. And at the same time, you know, Rolling in the Deep is on Spotify, you know, one of the most prominent streaming services. Rolling in the Deep has been the most streamed track of 2011 worldwide. So, you know, people are segregating the sort of CD and the streaming sort of sphere, and saying, you know, artists are either going to do well in this sort of area or well in that sort of area, and they need to sort of pick a side or pick a policy almost. But Adele's kind of shown that when the talent is there and when the content's right, the trend seems to go out of the window almost.
And with Adele's successes, do you notice that more people are now looking at the UK to dig up more talent? I mean, leaving aside the reality TV shows.
She's certainly been a massive ambassador for the UK, and certainly one of the things that a lot of UK executives are going to be looking to do next year is sort of seeing how you can sort of plug that gap without Adele there.
Of course. Yeah. Looking for the next Adele before she's only 21, isn't she? She's 22.
It'll be a
difficult task. Yeah. And who should we be listening to, in your opinion? What are going to be the names that will be?
In my opinion, personally, I think in terms of the UK, Emily Sandé had a really brilliant year last year. She really made the jump into the sort of the consciousness of the UK, at least. And I think with her debut album coming out this year, we can expect that to only increase. Elsewhere, Lana Del Rey in the US is also having a debut album this year. Obviously, last year her single Video Games was
the YouTube sensation.
Yeah, and it got a massive amount of airplay. So we're expecting big things from her as well, I think.
Brilliant. Well, Tom Pakinkas, thank you very much for joining us in the studio. Time for a song, fittingly. This is Lucy Lucy by Sean Lee. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll be talking broadcast, TV and technology. But first, here's the news headlines with Christian Yeo.
Thank you. Syrian state television says a suicide bomber has killed up to 25 people in Damascus. At least 46 others were injured in the blast in Midan district. Syria's state news agency blames terrorists for the attack. Aung San Suu Kyi says she's optimistic about a democratic future for Burma. She's held talks with the UK's Foreign Secretary, William Hague. Unemployment in the US has fallen to a near three-year low at 8.5%. 212,000 jobs were filled in the private sector. However, the number of posts in America's public sector fell by 12,000. The former boss of Japanese electronics and medical firm Olympus is giving up his fight to return to the company after losing his job for exposing a massive accounting scandal. Michael Woodford says it's taken too much of a toll on his family. He's now suing Olympus for unfair dismissal instead. And a ban on luxury spas at hotels and massage parlours in the Maldives has been lifted after pressure from the country's tourism industry. President Nasheed says he lifted the ban to make tourists feel welcome, comfortable and confident during their stays. And those are the stories at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Christian. Now, all this week on Monocle 24, we've been asking leading figures from industries of business, media, design about their hopes and predictions for 2012. And with internet channels, stop and rewindable live TV, and a vast archive of material now at our fingertips, the traditional role of gathering around the television for a must-see moment seems to be slipping away. So what will we be glued to on the box for 2012? I'm joined in the studio by the editor of Broadcast magazine, Lisa Campbell. Lisa, thank you very much for joining us on
Hello.
Midori House. Now, we were chatting a little bit before about the rise of live event TV. And this sort of follows on from the success of the royal wedding, you were saying.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, interestingly, it's one of the years, I think, when families will be gathering around the TV because there is so much happening in 2012. So we had the royal wedding last year. This year, that you know, there were swathes of international broadcasters that were present at the royal wedding. And that's set to be dwarfed by the Queen's Diamond Jubilee. It's expected to be, in terms of the outside broadcast teams in attendance producing this, it's going to be about four times bigger. Music is also an interesting one for broadcasters, with more live events taking place and being broadcast around the world. I think that's partly due to the rising cost of attending the events, and also, you know, people tightening their belts, really. So, for example, Coldplay headlined Glastonbury. That was broadcast internationally. So I think that's an increasing trend. But the big story for 2012, I think, is the Olympics.
Of course. We've just been hearing about the music from the Olympics, but how does it play out in the broadcast industry?
Well, the BBC is hoping that it will be the biggest TV event ever.
Right.
So the Beijing Olympics currently holds the record with 1 billion people globally tuning into that. Well, that was the opening ceremony that figure relates to. But with more TV homes now, the BBC estimates that this will be about 4 billion that will be tuning in and seeing at least some of the Olympics.
That's a lot of pressure on Danny Boyle for the opening ceremony.
It is indeed. And the BBC has a big connection with the Olympics. The first televised Olympics were held in London in 1948. And they're really keen that the games matter and define games as they've done in the past. So, for example, the Black Power salutes on the Mexican podiums, the Barcelona 92 Olympics ringing in the new, recently democratised Spain, and then Beijing really helping to define China as a superpower. So, according to the director of the BBC's Olympics coverage, a man called Roger Moseley, he thinks viewers want a sense of fun in dark times, in economic times. They want their communities to reunite. They want heroes to look up to. So these are, you know, this is something that the Games could really meet that need.
Of course.
The BBC also thinks it could help rebrand Britain to the rest of the world, which is also quite interesting. There's a sense that we're aloof and repressed and remote.
A nation of rioters and phone hackers.
Yes, yeah. And so the Games provide an opportunity to show that we're not like that. Well, not all of us anyway.
No, of course. And I want to also ask you a little bit about how people will watch the Olympics. I mean, 3D television has sort of been hovering around for quite a while, and sport seems to be the one area where it has really taken off.
Yeah, that's right. I think the Olympics provides a perfect platform for technical innovation, 3D particularly. So there's going to be about, I think, 300 hours will be in 3D. I mean, that's a fraction of the 5,000 hours which will be broadcast. But, it's still significant, and it suggests that we're moving beyond 3D as an experimentation and for archive. And it's not just the BBC which will be producing this. ESPN and NBC also has a commitment to 3D production. And what it will mean is, those lucky enough to have 3D TV sets will have about 10 hours of footage daily from about 14 venues, and that covers the opening and closing ceremonies and popular events like swimming and track and field and gymnastics. Sports such as swimming and canoeing have never been broadcast in 3D before, so, you know, that will be quite an experience for people and really enhance their viewing. So I think it will be a perfect showcase for what 3D can do and potentially galvanise more people into buying 3D TVs, which, you know, sales have been slower than anticipated.
It's a big investment still for a lot of people.
It is. But, it really does make quite a difference when, to certain sports. I mean, I was... I saw some footage of Usain Bolt thundering along the finishing line that Sky had done a sort of test recording, and it really was amazing. I mean, you do feel like you're there, and you could see every muscle and sinew in his body, and
really?
Beads of sweat and the whole thing. You know,
it definitely enhances the experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and the synchronized swimming, will that be in 3D?
Swimming will be, yes.
Okay, good. Well, I'm going to be buying my 3D TV for that. And I wanted to also quiz you a little bit about reality TV, which is something that dominates television here and in the States and for many parts of the world. There's no sign of it going away, but it does seem to be developing into something sort of even worse than reality TV, structured reality. Which
So structured reality is this kind of weird combination of drama, which is sort of partly scripted, and reality. I mean, how the producers describe it is everything that happens on screen, you know, would have happened, but they might say, okay, you know, you're planning to have a big heart to heart with your boyfriend. Can we do it at this venue with so and so there as well, or something? You know, so they'll kind of engineer some
tweaking
of those storylines.
Yeah.
But it is hugely popular. I mean, The Only Way Is Essex has been a massive hit for ITV2. And I think it's, you know, in social media terms, it's enormous. Apparently it's one tweet per second when The Only Way Is Essex is on.
Okay.
And then we had Big Brother, which Celebrity Big Brother launched on Channel 5 last night. The opening series, the first series, actually got 5 million, and the figures have just come in. It's actually down at 3.8 million. So, you know,
people are switching off, maybe.
Well, there are questions around the longevity, I think.
Of course.
But, you know, I mean, Big Brother is, you know, dates from the year 2000. So, you know, it's quite an old franchise now.
Of course. Well, thank you very, very much for joining us in the studio. And hopefully not too much structured reality this year. That's Lisa Campbell of Broadcast Magazine. Time for a song. This is Pass It On by Funk Community. That was Pass It On by Funk Community. It's 18:41 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Every week, Monocle's Jonathan Openshaw takes a look at the inspirational people behind some of the world's most fascinating businesses. We'll find out what they've learned from their triumphs and mistakes, how they manage their time, and what drives them on to success. No bulls or bears, just real people, real businesses, and real stories. That's The Entrepreneurs, presented in association with Pictet, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24, and also available on our Timeshift player at monocle.com and via iTunes. If you've missed any of your favourite programmes on monocle.com, tune in or download The Curator, our Sunday roundup of the best of the week's programmes on Monocle 24. With a different editor hosting every week, The Curator is your quick and easy way into the week's stories on Monocle 24. That's The Curator, brought to you in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24, every Sunday at 1300 London time, or via our timeshift player on monocle.com and on iTunes.
Welcome back. Now, Hashem Bajwa is CEO of Didi, a product development studio in New York. He spent his professional life unifying marketing and technology. After a long career in communications at the United Nations, he joins us on the line now to tell us a little bit about the technology that we have to look forward to in 2012. Hashem, thank you very much for joining us. I wonder if maybe we could start by talking about Kodak, which has obviously been in the press a lot with news that it may be about to go bankrupt.
Certainly. The story about Kodak is really remarkable because it is such an incredible, globally recognized brand. And I find that in the digital photography space, there are a few others that have the gravity that Kodak has had. And I think what's missing in a lot of the headlines, in fact, about the bankruptcy announcement is how inventive Kodak actually was in recent years. They were one of the first companies to build a digital camera with Nikon. They had an online photo site very early on called OPhoto. They invested heavily in research and development. The real challenge with Kodak was that they weren't able to take those technologies and actually turn them into sustainable businesses. And they sort of languished on some of their legacy and their history. They couldn't move nearly as quick.
A case of being hoisted by their own petard, maybe. Is it really the end, though? I mean, they've kept quite quiet and there's been sort of a few glimmers of hope. I see that they have 1,000 digital photography patents that they still own and are hoping maybe to sell these off. But, I mean, do you think the future is quite bleak for them still?
I don't think it's as bleak as the headlines would suggest. I think they have an immense amount of intellectual property, which today in technology is an immense currency. And further, their brand is very, very strong. They could easily move it into other sectors. I think we've even seen this with Polaroid and some of the things that have happened with the Impossible Project, where they've brought back Polaroid photos. They may not be as large as Kodak once was in the past, but they'll certainly find a place for themselves.
And, I mean, we mentioned earlier, it's obviously a very historic company. It's 123 years old, I think, isn't it? Is there a sense that nobody really wants to let such a brand die?
I think that's quite right. I think it's one of the few that have meaning across all kinds of demographics and countries and places. And it would be a great shame to see that erased. And frankly, few web or app companies have that kind of brand either.
No, of course. Let's move on, though, because I wanted to talk to you about apps as well. And finally, it seems like they may be moving from things of entertainment and social media into having a slightly more sort of worthy life. Is that right?
Yes, I think there's an immense social media fatigue that people are feeling going into 2012. And I think we'll see a number of applications that have been around for a little bit of time but are now going to be much more massively adapted by a larger sort of part of society. One I'm very excited about is Square, which is sort of a mobile payments company, and they've built a really simple, innovative credit card reader that plugs into the headphone jack of an iPhone or BlackBerry or Android phone and allows any individual person to take credit card transactions at a really low rate. It replaces all that old legacy equipment, fees, and sort of obscure technology that has existed for so long with credit cards.
And of course, I'm looking at a picture of it now, and it really is tiny, and you plug it into your phone. Is there nothing, sort of, it seems to me it could be a huge security risk with something like this, though. I'm guessing that's probably been thought out.
Yeah, well, what's remarkable is that they are still using all of the security systems that are built with a credit card. You're still using a Visa or a MasterCard or Amex, which have a number of security and fraud prevention things built into it. They're just making this process of using it way, way more simple and way more human, which I think is another trend or a thought we'll see with a lot of applications in the year, is how are they designed to be natural, to be intuitive, and to be much simpler.
Of course, and actually going beyond just easing everyday, today actions, there's one that I've been very interested in by LifeLens, the one that shows malaria in just a tiny pinprick of blood with 94% accuracy. And do you see that more people are using apps to think sort of across different sectors like medical and healthcare and sort of other such industries?
Yes, absolutely. And I think Square is a good example of how that can be now happening in the health area. LifeLens, where a small little attachment can take a pinprick of blood and make an analysis. The iPhone is way more than a phone in many respects. It's a powerful computer that can make, with the power of the internet, all kinds of computations really, really fast. Again, the question and challenge with the health sector is how to make it feel safe, feel private, and feel very easy to do. I think there's a great deal of trust one has walking into a doctor's office and being sort of sized up. This kind of application has to deal with that trust issue.
Of course, I'm not sure I want to go to the doctor's office and have somebody waving their iPhone at me to tell me what's wrong with me. But I think when it comes to something like diagnosing malaria in third world countries, obviously you can't dispute the benefit. Something slightly lighter, though, is the play button, which is another sort of gadget that looks very retro, but it's very clever. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, play button is sort of making music very, very tangible. It's a wearable button that can attach to any kind of clothing, very classic shape, very small, and it plays music. A little headphone jack on the side of it that you can plug into, and it's sold for about $20. What's unique about this, what's interesting, is that it's sort of a set of music that's handpicked by an artist or a musician, and it can't be altered or changed, combined with a small piece of artwork on the surface of the button. And I love this combination of a little bit of art with a sort of thoughtful collection of music. So it's not going to replace an iPod or an MP3 player, but it's a lovely kind of new addition.
So it's kind of a little bit gimmicky, but like a sort of short-lived marketing tool, or do you feel that it maybe has a bit more life in it than that?
It is a bit of an experiment, and it is a bit of an art project, but what it does suggest, I think, is a much more interesting one, is how technology might be a bit more wearable, a bit more natural, kind of woven into some of the things that we that are currently sort of dumb objects. So a button, for example, has new technology. They've found a way to make that a bit more interesting and interactive. We'll probably see more higher-scale versions of that.
Great. And then very quickly, finally, I wanted to hear about the end of SMS as well.
Yes, it's been much predicted. I think what's actually happening is an evolution of SMS, a change as the Internet changes. The SMS is sort of based on old cell networks. What the sort of shift I'm seeing with that is that it's prioritizing the access to the Internet over the sort of cellular carrier networks, which are legacy old companies that are using technologies very, very dated. That said, it is still limited to a few regions that have access to data in this way, who have high-end smartphones. In India, for example, there isn't ubiquitous data, so it's very, very difficult to use some of these new services. SMS is still really critical. There's a particular tool called the Life Tool developed by Nokia that's used in India to help fishermen track where fish are moving at the different points in the day. And it's a lovely sort of use of SMS that is appropriate for that market. So while, yes, people are answering SMS dying in the big markets, it's still very useful in others.
Yeah, no, I do see. And I don't know, it's obviously very different from Kodak, but SMS still has quite a sort of nostalgic association, doesn't it? It feels quite old-fashioned. I'm not sure I'm ready to see it go just yet myself.
Yes, it forces a brevity that is still really, really key.
Still key, of course, maybe not quite so so quick as BBM, which seems to be taking over, certainly in our offices. And finally, if there's one thing that we should be looking ahead to next year, one key thing that you could give us a couple of sentences about?
I think it will be the bridge of all the sort of online stuff. We've talked about Kodak and photo applications and all of the rest, but taking that technology and actually making physical things have greater meaning. I don't think it will be technology replacing our physical world. It'll make it better and more interesting. So I'll see more things like Square, where you have like the Internet making
Square
transactions.
Well, Hashem Bajwa, thank you very much for joining us on the line from New York. We are out of time, I'm afraid, for this Thursday's edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Paul Noble, researched by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Emma Nelson and Ted Kravitz will bring you the Monocle Daily later. That's at 2200 hours London time. We're back with Midori House at the same time on Monday. Headlines are next.